The United States and Saudi Arabia have had a long-lasting diplomatic and economic partnership since the 1930s. While the two countries have had that relationship for decades, it has been complicated. And the recent disappearance of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi has raised the tension between the two countries. It's alleged that Khashoggi, a well-known critic of the Saudi Arabian government, was abducted, possibly murdered, by Saudi agents at the nation's embassy in Istanbul. The White House and Congress are seemingly at odds over how to react to that event. Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies and Global Studies at Wayne State University. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, before we dig into the deeper relationships, there's still unanswered questions about the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi. What are you looking at in this story as all the countries involved look for details here?
Well, as things unfurl, Rob, what we do have is perhaps the most intriguing information, which is the Turkish government, because this allegedly took place at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Has claimed that they have both audio and video evidence showing not only that Khashoggi entered the consulate and not only that he didn't leave the consulate, but that he in fact was tortured, murdered, and possibly even dismembered inside it. Now, how the Turks were able to get such valuable information and intelligence probably caused them to be a little bit reluctant initially to disclose that information, because it suggests that they have been spying on foreign governments within sovereign soil, consulates inside their own countries. But nonetheless, that could then prove to be extremely embarrassing for not just the Saudis, but also the Trump administration, which thus far has at the very least been dawdling in its criticism and call for a thorough investigation from what otherwise is being considered one of the more important geostrategic allies of the United States in the Persian Gulf.
Let's give a listen to President Trump when he was asked what the U.S. planned to do in response. Here's what he had to say. This was yesterday, I believe, at a bill signing.
First, I want to find out what happened. And we're looking. Again, this took place in Turkey. And to the best of our knowledge, Khashoggi is not a United States citizen. Is that right? Or
permanent
is that
resident.
Right? He's a permanent resident. Okay. We don't like it, John. We don't like it. And we don't like it even a little bit. But as to whether or not we should stop $110 billion from being spent in this country, knowing they have four or five alternatives, two very good alternatives, that would not be acceptable to me. Okay, but we're looking for the answer, and I think probably you'll have an answer sooner than people think.
So let's dig into a couple different parts of that statement. Some people have read that comment that he's not a citizen, that this was in Turkey, technically on Saudi sovereign soil, as you mentioned, in the embassy. People saw that as the president distancing himself and the American government from criticizing Saudi Arabia. What do you make of that part of the statement?
Well, the United States has never been reluctant in the past to demand investigations for what it sees as being egregious conduct by various state actors around the world, even if it does not concern an American citizen or American resident. Here we do have, in the case of Jamal Khashoggi, a lawful permanent resident, a green card holder, if you will. And although he is not correctly, I mean, as the president says, a citizen, it still would trigger, one would think, certain kinds of demands to be placed. But I think perhaps the more important element in that is the president invoking the economics of this, which in many ways really does then define the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia for the better part of eight decades now. The fact that it's not just about oil, but it's about defense contracts, here talking about $110 billion, is a moment of almost refreshing candor that an American administration is being forthright with what exactly is the relationship between the kingdom and Washington. At the same time, it's erroneous to say that because of what the president feels is a hands-tied approach, that were the United States to exert more influence and pressure on Riyadh, that they would somehow become petulant and turn elsewhere to purchase weapons in what is, after all, a very lucrative and competitive arms market. The Saudis will not purchase arms from Russia. They will not purchase arms from China. First of all, because they haven't ever had them. Second of all, there's a lot of technical know-how, there's a lot of spare parts, and there's a lot of maintenance that goes into that, along with actually the training that goes into learning how to operate these munitions. That has all been, for the last 8 decades, really within the exclusive province of the U.S., and perhaps maybe to a lesser degree, Great Britain. So that concern that President Trump has is really ill-conceived.
Talking to Saeed Khan from Wayne State University about the latest between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia after the disappearance of a journalist of Saudi origin, a Washington Post columnist at the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. Saeed, taking a little step back now and putting this in some wider context, this is all going on in the midst of this war, basically, in Yemen. Saudi Arabia and its allies in the region involved in this, with U.S. blessing, going back to the Obama administration, using U.S.-made arms. We've got some senators from both parties in the last few months saying, hey, we should reconsider selling these arms. Talk about how Yemen fits into all of this.
Well, Yemen looms very largely because, after all, Saudi Arabia has been conducting operations there now for almost 5 years. In at least a stated effort to repel Iran's influence there. And yes, Iran certainly is supporting the Houthi rebels in Yemen. But the fact that Iran then becomes the boogeyman and is seen as the specter of real fear and real existential threat seems to then be driving a lot of the ambivalence and perhaps even the confusion as to what to do. And this is permeating even into the United States Senate. Reflexively, it would seem as though many senators, many congresspeople would demand that there be at least a suspension, if not a further level of punitive action against Saudi Arabia, especially even when it comes to the arms sales. But at the same time, particularly Republican members of the Senate have doubled down on this idea that Iran is, in fact, the existential threat. And as a result of it, it seems as though they're willing to give the Saudis a little bit more leeway than to come down as roughly as they otherwise would.
And this all goes to one figure in the Saudi government. He's gotten a lot of attention, Mohammed bin Salman, crown prince, heir apparent. A lot of people in the West looking at him as maybe this liberalizing force, pointing to allowing women to drive, among other things. But a lot of concerns about crackdowns on his rivals, both within his family and across Saudi Arabia. Can you talk about this key figure?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman, I think, sees himself in some ways as the Great Gatsby, in other ways as Michael Corleone. I'm not sure what other movies we can really invoke in this case. Maybe Commodus from The Gladiator. But he is a 32, 33-year-old, very charming, very charismatic, very multidimensionally thinking individual. He is, in fact, a crown prince. His father, King Salman, although the titular head of Saudi Arabia, suffers from dementia, is quite old and infirm. So essentially, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS as he's known, has been running the show in a variety of sectors. Minister of Defense, head of the Commerce and Investment Department, head of the Shura Council or the Justice Department. So essentially, the buck stops with him on all counts. He is rather impetuous. He certainly wants to move Saudi Arabia forward with his vision 2030 of modernization, of diversification of the economy beyond just oil, a certain level of liberalization. At the same time, he is an enigma and he's a paradox because, on the one hand, he has given women the right to drive, which has certainly mollified the West. But at the same time, he has also jailed many women reformers and advocates and activists within the country. So he is certainly giving with one hand and what it seems taking a lot more from the other. At the same time, he has made a charm offensive in many Western capitals like Washington, but also Ottawa, London, and Paris. And as a result of it, it seems as though he has charmed Western leaders into thinking that he is the future of a new Saudi Arabia. That is something that is rather dangerous because he has taken that then as a mandate and as a license to conduct some rather egregious campaigns, not only within Saudi Arabia, but as you mentioned before, the very large humanitarian crisis that he pretty much single-handedly has caused in Yemen.
We're talking to Saeed Khan right now, senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies and Global Studies at Wayne State University. He's with us to talk about the diplomatic relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and what might happen between the two countries following the disappearance and likely death of an outspoken critic of Saudi Arabia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you following this story of the missing journalist? Are you following the story of what's going on in Yemen? What do you think the United States should do when it comes to its relationship with Saudi Arabia? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. So we continue our conversation about diplomatic relations between the United States and Saudi Arabia with Saeed Khan. He's a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies and Global Studies at Wayne State University. You can join us with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Saeed about the past, present, maybe future of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia? And what do you want to see from Congress, from the president, when it comes to issues like arms sales from the United States to Saudi Arabia, what's going on in Yemen, and this case of the missing journalist Jamal Khashoggi? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to our callers now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, guys. My question is kind of a fact check of President Trump and what he's been claiming. He's been claiming there's a $100 billion arms deal in the pipeline and we shouldn't do anything to mess up that arms deal. And I've heard in reports that there actually is no signed deal, that there's just like a basically a letter of intent, or there's an intent to create an arms deal. So he's factually wrong about that. And then also he keeps saying that if we mess up this arms deal, it will end up in the hands of our competitors. But my understanding is that Saudi Arabia is basically locked into U.S. Services and weapons, and there really is no competitor standing in line waiting for the deal to fall through. I just wanted to fact-check Donald Trump's claims and see what your host or your guest says about that.
Thanks for the call. Saeed, you had mentioned earlier that because Saudi Arabia has bought a lot of American products in the past, they're some ways committed to maintenance, ammunition, things like that from us for the future. But talk about that. Yeah, I've seen challenges to that idea of a billion dollar arms deal.
Right, and thank you for the question, John. The $110 billion deal would be part of a package over several years. Second of all, it's important to also remember that the United States, since the signing of the so-called Iran nuclear deal back in 2015, has increased the sale of arms to not just Saudi Arabia, but also its neighbor, United Arab Emirates, in the tune of somewhere around $12 billion per year each. So what we're talking about is a complete package over a decade of weapons. It's not just weapons, of course. It would also be spare parts. It would be the technical training and the human capital that would go on in there. So in that sense, it is true. But John is right when it comes to whether or not there's a formal contract for these things. And part of that, I think, also has to be then taken with how close the relationship is between the United States and Saudi Arabia. When the president had gone to Saudi Arabia, which interestingly enough was the very first foreign country to which he went as a sitting president, he then made several deals with the king. And because the relationship between the Al Saud family and Washington has been so tight for the last eight decades, the idea then of needing a very formal written agreement is actually quite superfluous. The Saudis have certainly honored the commitments to which they have pledged in the past.
Thanks for that call, John. It's nothing new, Saeed, for U.S. presidents, administrations to have friendly relationships with Saudi Arabia. That goes back a long way. Do you see anything new and or different in the Trump administration?
Well, as you pointed out, Rob, I mean, this relationship starts off with then President Franklin Roosevelt on his way back from Yalta, meeting personally with the founding monarch of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz Al Saud, on a U.S. naval vessel in the middle of the Suez Canal in order to confirm American involvement, or I should say American corporate involvement, in Saudi Arabia's petroleum industry. Coming into the Nixon administration in the 1970s, President Nixon declared that
Saudi Arabia, along with Iran under the last Shah of Iran, was one of America's twin pillars of U.S. policy in the region and authorized Saudi Arabia to be eligible to purchase any conventional weapons in the American arsenal. During the 1973 Arab oil embargo, despite a formal declaration that the United States would be boycotted by the Saudis nonetheless continued to supply the U.S. military with oil for the Vietnam conflict. And then, of course, more recently, one could certainly infer, and certainly suspicion has been made about Saudi regime's complicity in 9/11. So despite all of those overtures, it shows that the relationship has been rather implacable. Now, regarding how the current administration is seeing it, perhaps the major difference that we find is, unlike any previous president, this president has actual financial ties to the Saudis that predate his election and seem to still be persisting there. So the personal benefit to the president is something that is unique and is unprecedented, so to speak.
Saeed, in our last minute or so, what are you watching for next, either from the Saudis or from the U.S. Congress?
I think what we're going to find from the Saudis is some effort to at least placate Washington, and it seems as though the bar is pretty low when it comes to the White House as to what that really means, some kind of an investigation, and here we're finding people who are under investigation investigating themselves, and that may not really lead to anything conclusive. At the same time, it'll be interesting to see if Congress will depart from the White House line and try to push for at least some kinds of sanctions or suspension in those arms deals that have been pledged.
We'll leave it there for now. Saeed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me again.
Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies and Global Studies at Wayne State University. With us today to talk about the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia and how it might change in light of the disappearance and likely killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Democrats don't just want to keep the Affordable Care Act. Some are moving to the left. Many in the party are supporting Medicare for all. In our final feature on how health care is playing out in this year's campaigns, Shemaine Mills has this report.
The current Medicare program is so popular, attempts to change it have been described as the third rail of politics. In other words, it's so charged, it's politically untouchable. Likewise, expanding to Medicare for all was once thought to be a lethal election year issue. Not so much anymore.
That is why we have got to join every other industrialized nation by passing a Medicare for all single-payer program.
During Bernie Sanders' presidential run 2 years ago, he told massive crowds like this one in Madison that health care is a right of all people. To be sure, it's a polarizing issue. Medicare for all still sparks cries of socialized medicine among Republicans. The very same night she won the Wisconsin GOP primary, U.S. Senate candidate Leah Vukmir wasted no time criticizing incumbent Tammy Baldwin on her support for Medicare for all.
She campaigns for single-payer, government-run health care. She's not afraid to stand with the avowed socialist Bernie Sanders.
But there are signs the public may be warming to the idea. The most recent Marquette poll found a majority of Wisconsin residents in favor of Medicare for all. Likewise, a national poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation showed a majority of Americans support a government-run, single-payer health care system. That support increases when talking about Medicare as a public option. Tammy Baldwin supports both.
These are all ideas worthy of debate right now, because while we narrowly defeated the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, our work is not done and we have got to address costs.
Baldwin says Medicare for all would reduce administrative costs and simplify a complicated system families find frustrating, like 55-year-old Bob Morrison from West Bend.
It gets hard sometimes to figure it all out, so sometimes you wish it would just be, hey, we can just go to the doctor and get taken care of.
Morrison says his wife had thyroid cancer along with hip and knee replacements. They resulted in surprise bills their insurer sometimes resisted paying. The self-described independent, who voted for Presidents Obama and Trump, sees flaws in the current health care system, but isn't necessarily ready for a big change.
You know, and I'm not so far against the, quote, single-payer system. I mean, we pay taxes for Social Security and everything out. We pay taxes for that. The only problem I have is putting the government in charge of all that money. That's scary.
Polls show support for single-payer drops off when people are asked about the potential cost. Then there's the logistics, transforming an entire system that relies heavily on private insurance now. It may be a heavy lift politically, but some like Lisa Marie Ludwig, a social worker from northern Wisconsin, hold out hope.
The only solution is to have a sort of baseline coverage that everyone is eligible for in the country. I know that politically we have a long way to go for that.
History suggests the odds could be long. There have been efforts to create a nationalized health care system dating back to 1945. If there's a difference now when it comes to Medicare for All, it's that more Democrats are willing to talk about it. Chemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can hear WPR's full three-part series on healthcare in the 2018 campaign at WPR.org. And some more campaign information, a debate tonight between Wisconsin Attorney General candidates Brad Schimmel and Josh Call. You can hear that tonight at 7:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio, moderated by Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg and WPR's Sean Johnson. And tomorrow, a Senate candidate debate. Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin and Republican challenger Leah Vukmir again join WPR for live coverage at 7 tomorrow. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a historian tells the history of two ideas, America First and the American Dream, and how they've come into conflict throughout U.S. history. And a Wisconsin author shares a new book aimed at sparking creativity for young girls. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day coming up Monday here on Central Time.